Top of the evening, everyone. I am Joseph Cotto. Joining me tonight in a rather rare take on the show, it's two people. One is Lipton Matthews, who you might have heard of, but he will introduce himself momentarily. And the other one is a fellow who needs no introduction, Paul Gottfried, referred to by some as the Godfather. Most, beyond question, one of our time's most intellectually strong, would that be the word? I think there's probably a more exalted way of describing it.
I think the word you're looking for is obnoxious.
No, I wasn't going to say that, but okay. he is without doubt one of our time's most worthwhile political commentators and theorists. I can't even begin to get into all the stuff Paul has done. Let's put it mildly when I say that his views have been, they have made friends and enemies, and mm-hmm. I think he enjoys making, I don't know, do you enjoy making friends or enemies more?
Enemies.
I figured as much, but he is the editor-in-chief of Chronicles Magazine now after having had a long career in academia. And Lipton, please introduce yourself to the audience.
Hello, good night. So I'm Lipton Matthews, and I'm a YouTuber, and I write for Mises, the intellectual takeout, Chronicles, Savvy Street, and the publications, and I'm looking forward to having a great discussion. That's all.
Outstanding. We all are looking forward to having a great discussion, even though it's about some pretty grim subject matter. We're going to be discussing, first and foremost, the situation at the border, which is appalling on many different fronts. There is an interesting article which Lipton wrote about immigration. It was published in Aporia magazine, and it is titled, "Does It Matter Where Immigrants Come From?" And the subtitle is, "Not All Groups Are Equal." Obviously, I like where this is going, and I'm sure Paul does. Starting out, immigration advocates claim that foreigners make America richer, increase productivity, and kickstart entrepreneurship. They churn out studies touting the benefits of immigration. But what do the facts say? Some immigrants arrive with high levels of education, others arrive with less. Those with high levels of education tend to be successful. Yet for certain countries of origin, even less educated migrants get ahead, for example, by establishing small businesses. Some groups become so successful that they manage to corner the market. This is achieved by honing human capital and cultivating social networks. South Koreans and Gujarati-speaking Indians achieve commercial prominence in the dry cleaning business and the hospitality sector, respectively. South Koreans are 34 times more likely to operate dry cleaners than other immigrant groups, and Gujarati Indians are 108 times more likely to manage motels. These kinds of success stories make the case for immigration sound plausible. However, repeating statistics that showcase some groups' accomplishments can't change the fact that other groups accomplish much less. Like talent in America, the abilities of immigrants are unequally distributed. I'll stop reading there. Lipton, I mean, it's very good that you wrote this. I mean, it goes without saying that's something that needed to be said. And once again, the article is titled "Doesn't Matter Where Immigrants Come From," published in Aporia magazine. People should look that up. Published on the 23rd of January. Lipton, what was it that inspired you to write this article?
We have been discussing immigration for some time, but the inspiration behind this article is Garrett Jones. So Garrett Jones published a new book, The Cultural Transplant, and I have a copy. Garrett Jones does really good research, but if you read that book, you're not going to end it by saying, "Oh my God, I don't want immigrants in America." So Garrett Jones is making the argument that immigrants transform culture and institutions. However, it is not a strident argument. So after the book was published and some academics wrote reviews, I decided to write this article to showcase the true qualities of productive immigration, because the reality is that immigrants from Europe make a difference. Many of these studies arguing that immigrants patent more than the typical American are exploiting the exploits of Europeans. So when Europeans went to Chile, they invested in new industries. When they went to Argentina, they built institutions. When they were in the Caribbean, they helped, they modernized the Caribbean. And that's why the Caribbean is more successful than Africa. There's actually an academic of African descent. He has a new book out arguing that Caribbean countries surprisingly do better than African countries, and they were colonized for a longer time. So the immigration story is really about the human capital of Europeans. Why do Europeans have human capital? They built the first universities. The Chinese discovered the art of printing, but printing in Europe sparked an intellectual revolution. The scientific revolution occurred in Europe. The first society to achieve the formal stage of cognitive operations, again, Europe. So Europeans already had an advantage before slavery and colonialism. One of the guests I interviewed some time ago, he has a new paper out on human capital in pre-industrial Europe. So we now have good data showing us that before slavery and colonization, Europeans were already building impersonal institutions, they had guilds, they had civil society, etc. So Europeans generally have more to offer. The Chinese were always experts. They were always brilliant, but Chinese people are not as individualistic as Europeans. And it's really because of individualism why the West was able to surge ahead. With individualism, impersonal institutions were built. It was easier for people to join social networks and share ideas. So Europeans, over the centuries, have accumulated more human capital than other groups. And by human capital, we're talking about bringing the product to market. So if there, let's say, for example, England and France are two countries. The literacy rate in France is higher than the literacy rate in England. However, the English are better at bringing products to market. Where are we going to have the Industrial Revolution? In England. And that's why England had an Industrial Revolution. English workers, the aristocrats and entrepreneurs were more adept at bringing products to market. It wasn't about literacy, it was about human capital. And human capital is an actual talent, it's a skill.
Fascinating stuff on a host of levels. And we'll get into where immigrants are coming from to the U.S. today and how that matters. But before that's addressed, Paul, anything to say about what Lipton brought up?
Yeah, I also find some of this these observations to be fascinating in terms of which groups offer, you know, special advantage to the host country that's accepting them. And, you know, exactly how do we choose between a Chinese who may have a very, very high natural intelligence, but may lack the creativity of, I don't know, a Frenchman or German or an Englishman or whatever, Italian. The problem, though, is that we don't make these choices, right? We simply have people crashing over our southern border right now. You know, we're not sitting back and saying, do we prefer this English merchant or Nigerian doctor or whatever? These are not the choices that we have. We simply have a southern border that's been overrun in order to bring in more voters for the Democratic Party, first in the state of Texas. So, you know, while I'm very, very sympathetic to the kinds of considerations that Lipton mentioned, I don't think they're particularly relevant to the way immigration is now proceeding in the United States.
I agree. You know, I read Thomas Sowell some years ago, and he said, at one point in America, policy analysts would document the achievements of groups, and that's how immigrants were selected. But that was a long time ago.
You know, I think we're talking about ideal circumstances, right? In which we're allowed to make these choices. And actually, most of these people seem fine to me. These are not the ones who are going to be coming.
It's an interesting situation, to say the least. An interesting situation, to say the absolute least. I mean, where does one even begin to get into America's immigration nightmare? I will say, Lipton, talking about some of the issues raised in your article, what do you think the consequences are of the present state of immigration to the United States? What do you see happening as a result of that? I think obviously we'd all agree, terrible situation.
No, America has succeeded at assimilating immigrants. So contrary to criticisms, immigration policy in America has been successful, but that is changing because of wokeism. We're no longer encouraged to assimilate immigrants into American values. So people are imported, people are being imported into America, and they're being encouraged to hate America. So it's only going to lead to disaster. That's what I'm predicting. They're coming here to acquire human capital or to learn American history. They're coming here to talk about systemic racism and to say that white men are bad. That's what's going to occur, because this is the current trend. America is no longer seen as special.
But isn't that the ideology of the United States? I mean, you know, they say, well, we want people to come to Germany, and we want them to become integrated, you know, as the Germans would say, das war eine deutsche Kulturgemeinschaft, das war eingebunden zu werden, to become integrated into a German cultural community. Well, there is no German cultural community. They're destroying themselves. They hate themselves. And the question arose a few years ago in Germany, whether Turks could become fully German unless they're taught to hate themselves and feel guilt as a nation. So, I mean, this has become the dominant ideology in these Western liberal democracies. And there really is nothing for the people coming in to assimilate into except to take over this hatred for white people, Western civilization, Christianity, Judeo-Christianity, whatever. You want them to take this over, because this is the new American creed. And you cannot blame the people coming in if they don't express patriotic sentiments, because the Americans who are letting them in aren't particularly patriotic. Indeed, they're just the opposite.
But what I also find interesting is that some people, like myself, we will migrate to countries like the UK and America because of what they represent. Mm-hmm. We want to live in a productive country with smart scholars and innovators and institutions like Silicon Valley. But with the downside, I call it downward assimilation. Assimilation is usually upward, but we're experiencing downward assimilation today. Right. So when I leave Jamaica and let's say I go to America or England, I want to see a clean society. I don't want to see mentally unstable people sleeping on the floor. I don't want to see prostitutes in public. But we have reached a point in Western society where culture and standards do not matter. So the productive people from the third world who are migrating to America, many of them are going to end up disappointed because they live in America where, according to some, homeless people have a right to defecate on the street. Mm-hmm. So the productive people, they're going to end up really disappointed when they enter places like America and worse, France.
Of course, many of these productive people land up voting for the political parties which are doing this, because they are allied to the woke left, you know, starting with corporate capitalists, professionals, people who attend Ivy League universities, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the productive people really aren't doing their part, you know, to maintain a productive society, certainly not in terms of those they're bringing in. And, you know, they really have no objection to bringing in, one might say, the dregs of humanity, because these are people who do their bidding. They'll take, you know, low wages to work for them. They'll vote the way they're told, in return for living off of government favors, or getting doles and so forth. So, you know, the productive people are not necessarily the ones who are making, you know, wise political choices for the rest of us.
And I also, well, if you want to go ahead and speak, Joseph, you can, but find it really troubling that as an individual who buys a ticket to travel to America to do business or to attend a conference, you're hassled. You're hassled when you're coming here, but people can just walk into the country with no skills whatsoever. I find that really troubling. So if I'm traveling to America, let's say to attend a chronic, to attend a conference sponsored by Chronicles. I am asked, why are you coming here? Who is Paul? How do we show that you're not lying? I'm asked these stupid questions, but any random person can just walk into America. That's what I find really troubling.
Not anybody can walk into America, only illegals.
Yes.
Normal people can't. They don't have to do lines and be searched, you know. When we had COVID, they didn't have to wear masks, they didn't have to be examined. They let them in because the Democratic Party wants more voters. And they were able to get, you know, they were able to divert public attention. If you remember in 2022 and 2023, some of the elections came, people were screaming about what women, abortion, or they're going to pay off their college debts, which they didn't do. But, you know, the left in the United States has so much power that they can divert attention. The media will cooperate. The Democratic Party, which really is the majority party now in the country, are able to divert attention from what you see as a serious problem to get people to vote for something. The whole abortion issue, by the way, is nonsense. So there have been many times more abortions since the Dobbs decision than there were before. I think that in the last 2 years, the number of abortions has tripled compared to what it was before the Dobbs decision. So people are not being denied, but they can just go on using the issue, and they'll sort of use it forever, and then they'll find some other social. But these are all diversionary tactics, because they don't want people to notice what's happening at the border, right? They don't want people to notice the crime in the cities, so they have to find other issues on which they can focus public attention, and they did it very successfully in the last two national elections.
I'm happy that you mentioned abortion, because mm-hmm. the truth is that middle and upper middle class women are not having abortions. Feminists are not having abortions. Working class women who think that they don't have options are having abortions. Mm-hmm. And many people who support abortion do so because they think that it is eugenic. They're not going to say so publicly, but that's why they support abortion. They want people with lower levels of education to have abortions. That's the real goal behind abortion. It's not about female rights or female empowerment.
I think you're partly right. They will give other explanations, but I think there is, in fact, a eugenic concern among these sort of woke upper-class people who are trying to push abortions on the lower classes. They want to keep their population down.
It's not about.
I only heard a person admitting that once, and that was about 25 years ago. I mean, somebody we're not talking about Joseph Cotto right now. We're talking about people on the left who admitted that to me. They were coming from a pro-abortion rally when I lived outside of Washington, and they said, you know, you think these people would understand that we know you have to keep the population down. There's certain people we don't want, you know, to reproduce, and so. That was the only time I ever heard people tell me what I think is probably a very widespread concern among pro-abortion people.
Yes, because most victims of rape and incest don't have abortions. Mm-hmm. And when these writers want people to support abortion, they often say, if a woman gets pregnant and has no money, are you going to adopt her baby? That's the usual argument. It's not about the ethics or the philosophy of abortion. It's all about, okay, then, it's not pragmatic for her to have children because she has mm-hmm. no money. That's the argument.
Joseph, you've been silent for most yes. of the conversation.
Well, I'm here to listen to what Paul and Lipton have to say, and it is fascinating. The abortion issue obviously is a terrible one for the Republicans. It is used, as Paul said, as a diversion by the Democrats, and there's no way that's going to stop, although the Republicans did back themselves into a corner by pursuing in many states some really radical anti-abortion laws. In Texas, it was banned outright, basically, and in Florida, it hasn't taken effect yet, thank heavens, but there is the 6-week ban that Ron DeSantis signed. It's unpopular to the tune of about 70% of the electorate, and it looks like there's going to be a referendum this year on the ballot to restore abortion to what it's been for decades in Florida, up until very recently, legal up to 24 weeks. So it's the abortion issue definitely is one that the GOP should avoid, because the Democrats use it as a diversionary tactic. They use it very successfully. The Republicans, rather than being going where the public is, instead have gone to some really bizarre places. The public generally supports abortion being legal through the first trimester, with restrictions beginning at the fetal stage, which starts obviously with the second trimester. Exactly where those restrictions would set in during the second trimester, that's you know, very much open to question, and it varies state by state. But the GOP has handled this issue, the abortion issue, terribly, whereas the Democrats have leveraged it to great success. And I say that as someone who's obviously not a Democrat, but it's, you know, it is what it is. Paul, then Lipton, anything to say about what I brought up?
Well, I'm going to respond to this. I think if you ask most people, most women, if you ask them in polls, and I've looked at these polls, they're not really very far off where DeSantis is. Theoretically, you know, the 6 weeks or the first trimester or something like that. The Democratic position is totally unrestricted abortion until the baby descends through the birth canal. And even there, if you remember, Governor Northam said you can kill your baby afterwards, which is also the position in New York State and some of us in Massachusetts and other places. So the Democratic position is totally wacko, but the women are convinced that they will have no abortion rights if the Republicans win, because the Democrats tell them this and they believe it. The Democrats also say that women have been the victims of men historically, and they're just righting this wrong by giving them abortion rights. But the Republicans are in a bind, because the positions that they take, even someone like DeSantis, are not out of line with how people respond on polls. But the Democrats can always demagogue the issue very successfully by making it appear that every Republican wants to take your abortion rights away entirely from women, which is not the case. Or they'll say, if DeSantis is doing this, this is really a stage to take away all your abortion rights. And they've been able to play it very well. And this works particularly among unmarried women and suburban women.
I have to add, though, that a lot of Republicans have supported outright bans, a lot. There are even some in Florida here who want it, even they're clearly not going to get it.
Some have, you know, in Kentucky and other places, but most have not. Mm-hmm. And in Pennsylvania, when Dr. Oz ran against Fetterman, he said he'd do absolutely nothing about the abortion issue. You know, he totally swore off the abortion issue, and yet it was used against him successfully by the Democrats.
Because of Mastriano's
he wasn't running on Mastriano's position. He made it very clear when he was running. It's just that the Democrats are always able to demagogue the issue. Women are going to have abortions in back alleys. The media plays into this. But it's not because most Republicans are taking unreasonable positions. They're taking the same positions as those that people are taking in answering polls. But their answers on polls have nothing to do with how they feel. You know, anyone who speaks about restricting abortion really wants babies, you know, to be fetuses to be destroyed in back alleys and women to be enslaved and so forth. So on the emotional level, they're, you know, the Democrats are able to successfully manipulate the situation.
I will add, before Lipton says anything, I'm sure he has a lot of things to say before we get back to the immigration issue, that the Republicans needed a unified strategy after Roe was repealed, which is terrible for the GOP politically, Roe getting repealed, but that's another matter for another time. I say that, though, even while conceding that the constitutional basis for Roe was weak indeed. I'm someone who never tried to defend Roe constitutionally, right, even though I liked the impact of it socially and politically and economically. Mm-hmm. But talking about the GOP, they had no comprehensive strategy. There were different factions going off saying different things, and that caused a situation in which the most extreme voices were amplified by the Democrats, who obviously control the media, not just the Democrats who hold elected office. These people amplified the most extreme Republican position, and the GOP could not rally around a counter to this extremism. So every Republican basically was fending for him or herself, and that, you know, allowed the Democrats to run roughshod over the GOP on this abortion issue.
Yeah, the only way you can successfully counter it is something that Nikki Haley has done, is to say that, you know, women, yes, they have been victims of chauvinism in males, and you know, I'm against abortion, we have to discuss this, or something like that. You have to take a very, very soft, mawkish approach to this, and concede that women are victims. And if you start from that position, you may have a chance before the Democrats successfully, you know, tried to demagogue the issue. But, you know, I was stunned by what the Democrats did with that issue, because I didn't think it was going to, you know, affect work against the Republicans very much.
And I thought it would. We had discussions about this.
But, you know, they can take any issue because they control the media, education in the media. They can do anything they want, and they can lie about it very well. And the question is, you know, how can you escape the effects of their distortions of reality? And I do agree, Republicans really had no strategy.
Mm-hmm. No, they didn't. They really didn't. Yeah. And I will say that what the GOP can do to put this, well, it can't really put the issue to bed, but it can certainly allay some of the worst impacts of the abortion cause. What it can do is say we support abortion through the first trimester, and after that we support restrictions. That would be the smart thing. That would be the sensible thing. The overall majority of abortions take place in the first trimester, and most Republicans will go along with that. As a matter of fact, Ron DeSantis thought that his hardcore anti-abortion stance would woo evangelicals in Iowa away from Trump, and it didn't work out. And so most Republicans are not voting single issue on anti-abortion politics. It's a very small element of the party that cares about it that much, but they're vocal and they show up disproportionately in closed primaries. And so a lot of Republican politicians think they have to cater to this element, but it's much wiser to say we support abortion through the first trimester, and after that we support restrictions. So go ahead. I
wrote a column for the Blazek. I didn't send this to either you or Lipton. It came out today, in which I argue that the one overriding issue for Republican voters, it is not getting rid of Donald Trump's chaos, with all due respect to Nikki Haley. It is clobbering the other side, making them pay the things that Biden did. And there really is a lot of anger against Biden. And the reason they support Trump, however awkwardly and aptly and rudely Trump speaks, is because he hates the same people they do. Uh-huh. And and he also tells them that I'm protecting you. I'm taking this beating, you know, which you would suffer. He's sort of like, he's a Christ-like figure. He's standing there and suffering for everybody. And they believe this. So I don't think the abortion issue is going to weigh very heavily in the next election. I think the border is going to overshadow everything else. And that's what we're supposed to be discussing right now.
Yes.
Yes. And I'll just say one last thing. I really want to get back to Lipton just to talk about something Paul said. Abortion is not going to be that big this year. There's no polling data, reliable polling data. I'm not talking about BS polls, which indicates that abortion is the top issue. That was a 2022 thing. A big reason as to why this is happening is because more states are holding referenda on it. So voters correctly think that I will voice my pro-choice sentiment on the referendum, but I'm not going to vote one way or the other for a candidate based primarily on the abortion issue. You have your small band of hardliners, but you know, those people are just that, a small band. So abortion is not going to be that big this year. It understandably was huge in 2022, but what's going to happen is that more and more states hold referenda on abortion wherever this is possible, and the pro-choice perspective wins, and eventually the anti-abortion cause just continues to shrivel up and hopefully go somewhere way into the woodwork that they're not heard from again. That's the best case situation for the GOP. Lipton, please, I'm sorry that you've not been able to speak for a while now.
No, but I find it strange that Democrats have managed to weaponize abortion to this extent, because the reality is that historically, abortion was not unusual. So in the Roman Empire, for example, men had control over the body of women and they could determine abortion. Abortion became unpopular because of Christianity and the new morality that it introduced. So whenever I read articles on abortion, I often say, are we regressing by supporting abortion? Because historically, the concept of life was different. The fetus was not deemed to be important. But today, there is a premium on life, even on the life of a fetus. And we have managed to fabricate that argument to indicate that the fetus is not a real baby, so we don't need to care about the life of the fetus. The fetus is just an object that can be disposed of, and it is couched in such emotional terms that we cannot have an analytical discussion on the topic. Because the truth is that on moral and ethical grounds, abortion is not that appealing. If you're thinking about it at the granular level, the fetus is medically is not the woman's body. So there's no property right to abortion. And if there's no property right to abortion, it cannot be a benefit of privacy. So Roe v. Wade had to be overruled. So legally and philosophically, I don't think that the arguments endorsing abortion are really potent. But for some strange reason, people take it super seriously and they continuously link to female empowerment. This is what I am unable to understand. Why people are so passionate about abortion?
Well, I mean, I think I'll just throw this out there before we get back to finally to immigration, although yeah. I'm sure Paul will need to comment on what I'm about to say. It's important to a lot of people. Well, primarily it's important to women because they want bodily autonomy. And in America, there is a longstanding, even though there's no national binding culture today, there definitely is an expectation, which is cultural. It's descended from the country's history that people will do what they want with their lives. And a lot of women believe that in order to fully do what they want with their lives, they have to be able to choose to terminate a pregnancy at least up to a certain point, because otherwise they are living a man's life, since the man did something to them which resulted in the pregnancy. That's the core of the female support for abortion. And I actually understand that. I support abortion being legal up until fetal viability, but I can live with it being restricted from the second trimester onward. But when it gets people like me, why we support abortion, it's, I mean, there is an appreciation of individual rights and liberties. I think it's pretty dangerous for the law to consider something which is not viable to have the same rights as someone who, you know, has been born. But that's really another philosophical consideration. But there's the practical element, which is that the people who get abortions are the self-selecting minority of society that would make truly terrible parents, and their children would grow up to perpetuate almost certainly a horrendous sociological cycle is probably the best way of describing it, that was set forth by the parents. It was probably set forth by their parents, and it goes back on and on. If you look at a lot of the people who get abortions and the problems which lead them to get an abortion, you see that they come from a background which is highly dysfunctional, and if they don't, they would be starting a cycle of dysfunction with their offspring. So it's, you know, it's something that deals with the self-selecting minority of people who would drag down society by having kids. So that's my very utilitarian argument for abortion, at least until fetal viability. Only until fetal viability. After that, it's only to save the life of the mother that there would be the need for an abortion, or where I think abortion would be in any way permissible. So that's, you know, there are different arguments for abortion. There is essentially the feminist argument, which I articulated first, and then there's my practical argument. I think that any argument for abortion probably falls into one of these two camps, at least in the U.S., although there are other arguments for abortion as well, but I do think they probably boil down to one of these two camps. Paul, then Lipton, anything to say about what I just brought up?
Yeah, Lipton raised an interesting question about at what point in Western history is abortion considered wrong? And I would say at least theoretically, from early Christianity on, from the time the baby quickens or the fetus quickens, it's considered to be a full human life. Now, among the Jews, there was in fact a contradiction, because on the one hand, they took the same position the Christians and the Muslims would take about the time, from the time that, you know, the fetus quickens. But we know that if one destroyed a woman carrying a baby, one destroyed that fetus, and you suffered a penalty, it was a financial compensation that you made to her husband, because women have very few rights in Hebrew scripture. So you have to make the amends to the husband, but it's not treated as homicide. If unintentional homicide, you'd have to go to one of the cities of refuge until the death of the high priest. So that we know that there is not a consistent position there. Later in Rabbinic Judaism, there's the same position is taken that you find in Christianity. However, it was not strictly enforced. People were not put to death for destroying fetuses, or as far as I know. Because until the time you gave birth to the baby, it was sort of a kind of uncertain thing. It sort of let it go. Through most of my early life, abortion was considered terrible, and it was criminal. And it was considered the taking of human life, which was the dominant Christian view, and it was also shared by religious Jews. So, I mean, you know, you're not supposed to do this thing. The attitudes change. At least in part because abortion becomes legalized, thanks to Governor Rockefeller in New York and Governor Reagan in California, who do this, by the way, quite early, you know, in the 1960s. And even before Roe v. Wade, which comes in 1973. Attitudes do change. Now, I'm not actually entirely in disagreement with Joseph Cotto. I'd be very happy if abortion laws were the way he would want them to be. However, the Democrats and the feminists, and you know, these feminist women, want a totally unrestricted right to abortion, and any attempt to restrict their rights to abortion up until the baby comes out of the birth canal, maybe, you know, even after the baby comes out of the birth canal, is seen as male chauvinism, a sexist intervention on their reproductive rights, etc., etc. So these people are very hard to satisfy, because they really feel aggrieved. They feel they're living in a male Christian theocratic society, in which women are still being oppressed, although God knows they have much more power than men, but they're always oppressed, right? By definition, they're the oppressed group. So, as long as they vote, as long as they have influence, that is going to remain an issue. Although I think it is, I think, as Joseph said, it probably is going to be overshadowed by other issues this year, and as referenda take place in the states, they just take place. In some places, there'll be, you know, more. I don't think the pro-life people are going to go away. I think they're going to win in some places. You know, they're conservative places in which they're going to win, but certainly in the big blue states, they're going to lose badly, and in even some of the red states. But I think that's the way the issue is going to be solved. I just don't think it's going to work as well for the Democrats this year as it did in the last two elections.
Quick point: abortion benefits a subcategory of men. Feminists believe that they're challenging the system by having abortions. However, if men impregnate women and opt to not father those children, and the women have abortions, then who benefits?
Mm-hmm.
The men. So abortion actually gets men off the hook. That's why
I think you're right, by the way, that that very often you hear, well, you know, you have to consult the man as well as the woman. Theoretically, I agree, but most often the men aren't particularly concerned, right? They just want to get rid of the bear.
Exactly. So they're fighting a losing battle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, talking about the border situation, obviously the Democrats are exacting a political strategy. Now, the strategy is too complicated to really flesh out here, but you could go over it in a very cursory sense. The Democrats really, really want to win Texas. The core of the illegal crossings, it is in Texas.
Right.
Texas is a state that is not as red as it used to be. It's been on a blueing trajectory for about 20 years now. Ever since George W. Bush's second, the high watermark for the GOP in Texas was George W. Bush's second term. Then, you know, it's not become a Democratic state, but it certainly has had a few close calls, and it does look like that's going to end. So the Democrats want to just get Texas out of the running for the GOP and make it their own, and they believe they can do that by importing a new electorate. Mm-hmm. Will wind up getting legal status after, you know, increased lobbying, obviously a pathway to citizenship, which is accelerated. And that would, within an election, probably within 8 years, make Texas a solidly blue state. And if that happens, given the vast amount of congressional districts in Texas, given the electoral college the gold mine that it is, that would make it so the Democrats have a solid lock on the presidency, and in all likelihood a lock on the U.S. House, even if the Republicans do well elsewhere. It does not matter for the GOP if you win Florida, Georgia, and Pennsylvania if you're losing Texas. So the Democrats, I think what they see happening is that even though places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan reverted to the Democrats for Biden, however legitimately or illegitimately that was, it's another question for another time. But even if it was illegitimate, it was close enough that the Democrats were able to cheat. But if it can be made, if Texas can be made into a legitimate blue state wherein no cheating is necessary to win it reliably, then everything else goes out the window. The Republicans win, you know, the Republicans can win Wayne County, which is where Detroit is. And if they lose Texas, it doesn't matter if they're winning even Philadelphia. It just doesn't matter at that point. That's how irrelevant everything becomes if Texas goes Democratic. So I think the Democrats are strategically engineering an electorate in Texas. Illegal aliens, if given citizenship, would of course vote Democratic because they see the Democrats as the party that is their salvation. The Democrats were fighting to give them citizenship. The Democrats are fighting to have more of the illegals' family members come over here than would be allowable through the presently legal process. The illegal aliens also very much want and expect some sort of public benefit system as quote-unquote asylum seekers, and the Democrats would always outdo the GOP in offering handouts. So there's no question in my mind that Biden's administration wants to border open because they're bringing in a new electorate that within 8 or so years that they imagine will make Texas blue, and that makes everything else basically irrelevant. That's why I think this crisis at the border is really happening. Lipton, then Paul, anything to say about what I brought up?
I agree. The Democrats can succeed because they appeal to some on the right. So they're libertarians who argue that one way to make America richer is to admit the wretched refuse of the world. Mm-hmm. So the current argument on the mainstream right is that Republicans are hostile for criticizing illegal immigrants. One writer, she writes for Bloomberg View, she contends that we're not facing an invasion. That's her argument. And she has a large following behind her. So the Democrats, they have managed to infiltrate their ideas into Republican circles, especially the pro-libertarian circles, the research institutions like Cato, etc. So I think that the Democrats will win. They're going to succeed because it's an emotional issue. And we should also remember the notion of America being a propositional nation. America is a land of opportunity. Therefore, if you deprive people of their ability to live in America, you are robbing them of an opportunity. So the Democrats, they have an emotional argument, and they are actually winning.
Yeah, there are two points I would make. First, addressing Lipton's point, or his observation, he's correct that there are Republicans who think that this is a blessing for us. It provides cheap labor. It brings more people, you know, into a land that welcomes immigrants, however they get here. And you always hear stories, you know, my grandfather came from Italy and he was illegal and this, you know, What right do we do, have to discriminate against these poor people? We should give them what they want, etc. So there is an element to the Republican Party, perhaps most closely identified with the Bush family, that would make this kind of argument. But I think Joseph may be too hesitant, reserved in his argument. There's no reason you have to wait 8 years. The Democrats in Texas want to get rid of Ted Cruz. He only won against Beto O'Rourke by 2.5 points, maybe less than that. Right now, he's running neck and neck in polls against a very, very leftist black Democrat from Houston. And, you know, if you can get enough of these people enfranchised by the next time Ted Cruz runs, you can get rid of him. You know, they're spending $100 million, the Democrats, to dump this guy. Getting rid of somebody like Abbott may be a little harder, but you can certainly get rid of one of your senators, the one who is more conservative and speaks out against the Democrats the more emphatically and more eloquently. And he is the main target in the Senate for the Democrats. I also don't think they're only concerned about Texas. You have other states into which the illegals are crossing: New Mexico, Arizona. Arizona is still open, you know, it's still open to Republican competition. It's still in contention. New Mexico is a little more solidly Democratic. We can go either way there too. So just bringing in illegals into those border states, Texas and also the Arizona and New Mexico, can be very useful for the Democrats. If you also notice, at least initially, the Biden administration was not very happy to have these people move out of Texas. I mean, it then supplied airplanes, then go to Westchester County, New York, and this. But these were small numbers. They wanted to keep the bulk of this of the illegal population where they came in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, because they need them for political purposes, particularly in Texas.
Absolutely. It's terribly distressing, but it is what it is. I will say, I said 8 years because there's no way these illegals are going to be legalized and given citizenship voting rights by this November. I think it's a longer term strategy. Now, Ted Cruz theoretically could lose this November without the illegals. That is just Texas's natural blueing trend. Now, do I think Ted Cruz will lose in November? No, I think Trump will carry it for him. Trump is running well ahead of Biden in Texas. It's not really competitive. Right, Biden is not campaigning in Texas. He's going to lose Texas. But Ted Cruz, a few things with Ted Cruz. He is uniquely unlikable, his personality.
I agree.
Yeah. I don't think so.
I disagree, but obviously Lipton will be able to speak his piece. But the second thing is that, as Paul brought up, Ted Cruz is a doctrinaire conservative, and that doesn't even appeal to all Republicans, or arguably most Republicans at this point. Ted Cruz is something of a throwback to a more conservative era. The third issue is that Ted Cruz manages to turn people off who are social moderates. This relates to his doctrinaire conservatism, obviously, but it's also a personality thing. He repels social moderates who would either not vote against Trump or they would even support Trump. And so he has all these problems. He will run several points behind Donald Trump in Texas. Absolutely no question. I think he squeaks it out by about 1 to 2 points. I doubt it will be any more than that. His absolute ceiling, I think, is 3. But it's not going to be an easy race for him to win. The Democrats, I can tell you, here in Florida, they're not even focused on it anymore. They used mm-hmm. to be here with a very active strategy to win anything they could in a statewide contest every 4 years. Or whenever a Senate seat was up, not necessarily, but 4 years. Obviously, Senate seats are elected every 6 years, and then you have different seats being up in different election cycles. But the thing of it is, the Democrats are basically writing Florida off because it's become much, much more Republican. Now the Republicans have like a 700,000 plus lead on the Democrats in voter registration. And the Democrats just lost, I think, since this year began due to inactive voters being purged, like 100,000. So the numbers, the stats I just spoke about are a bit out of date, and they're out of date in the GOP's favor. If you are here in Florida, as I am, you're not seeing anything about Democrats running for anything statewide. Mm-hmm. It's radio silent. And that is newer. It was sort of this way in 2020, definitely not in 2018. 2018 here was the last truly competitive election cycle. But the thing is, this gives a lot of Republicans a false sense of security. And I wrote about that, that a lot of Republicans think because, you know, we had to win Florida, that's the national bellwether, then if we win that, everything will be okay. No, it won't be, because number one, Florida is not really a national microcosm at all. Number two, Republicans are moving to Florida in such a large quantity that it's become a vote sink. And for those who don't know what a vote sink is, it's when so many people from one party live in an area that their votes are concentrated mm-hmm. there, and places that they move from go to the other party because they obviously become less competitive due to the changing political demographics. Texas, it has not attracted as many Republicans as Florida has. It actually produces less Republicans among its natives than Florida does. At least when Ted Cruz ran for the Senate last time, which was in 2018, he did better among people who had moved to Texas than people who were actually born mm-hmm. in Texas. So you can't really say it's the Californians turning Texas blue, because actually it's probably the Californians keeping it Republican. But the people who are born in Texas are surprisingly left-leaning. Why that is, given Texas is very traditionally Christian conservative, whether it's Protestant or Catholic, you know, political and religious culture, that's a hell of a question. I'm not an expert on Texas. I really don't care that much about it, to be honest. I'm just telling you about the situation as it is. The fact of the matter is that the Democrats are going all in on Texas because they do see it as their future. They see it as their future in presidential races, not this time around, but certainly from 2032 onward. And they also see it this time around as being something that they could profit from in the U.S. Senate. So Texas is in a tough spot. And then the border crisis on top of that just magnifies how much the Democrats, it also amplifies how much the Democrats want to win that place. How they're trying to get all these illegals in place in Texas so that when they do get citizenship, they will solidify it as a blue bastion. And then the Republicans, as I mentioned, they can win not only Pennsylvania, but Philadelphia County, and it won't make a damn bit of difference in the presidential.
Yeah, I disagree with you a bit about Texas. We know why Texas is blue. You have a very large black population in Houston, Dallas, these other cities, and they vote solidly for the Democratic Party, and for the left wing of the Democratic Party. You have large academic communities in Austin and other cities. They also vote for the left. The Mexican Americans traditionally have been Democrats, but they're changing. They're moving into the Republican Party very quickly. And I think this will benefit the Republican Party in Texas. I think they will do generally better than what the Democrats think will be, you know, will be the future situation there. I think Cruz does have a serious problem of not being liked. And I do agree with just about every position he takes. And I still don't like the guy. And he speaks well. But I just find him very off-putting. And I don't like the man. I wouldn't vote for president. I mean, when he ran in the primary, because I didn't like him. And I noticed my wife does have other people don't like him. And he does put them, there's a certain kind of arrogant manner or something about him that makes him unappealing. The same thing, by the way, may be true about DeSantis, who I think would have been the best nominee for the presidency. I much prefer him to Trump, but he's not what people don't like his person. People outside of Florida don't seem to like his personality. In the case of Cruz, people in Florida, in Texas, and outside of Texas don't like his personality, which is a problem. I think some of these other people, like Abbott did pretty well the last time they ran for governor. Patrick, the lieutenant governor, did well. Yeah. Ken Paxton, the attorney general. I think Cruz has a problem, projecting himself, as a likable public figure. But I do think that what the Democrats are doing now is very definitely aimed at making Texas blue very, very fast. You know, and I agree entirely with Joseph on that point.
It's easy to lampoon Ted Cruz. He's a smart guy and really conservative. But both of you have been making an excellent point. And this point is that the appeal of Trump is that he's an anti-globalist. So Trump hates the managerial elite. That's why Trump is going to win again. Donald Trump was bullish on China. Joe Biden is bullish on China. Donald Trump pandered to blacks. Joe Biden is pandering to blacks. What's the difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden? Trump is an anti-globalist. Donald Trump is an anti-globalist and Joe Biden is a globalist. That's the difference. And that's why Trump has a deeper appeal, because he's able to combine the politics of anti-globalism with issues like immigration and job security for working class Americans. That's the appeal of Trump.
He's also socially more conservative, or he has a following that's socially more conservative. I mean, he's not going to say that men can give birth to children, which Biden thinks is fine, or, you know, we're going to mutilate children to change their genders, which Biden thinks is fine. Trump has a much more conservative constituency, which would never, you know, bind to any of these things. So, and, you know, also accept traditional gender roles and so forth. So, in the United States, as in Europe, the working class is the most conservative class on social and cultural issues. And those are the people behind Trump. They're not behind Biden. Says, you know, labor unions love me, by which he means the heads of labor unions who are paid off by the Democratic Party love him. the members aren't going to vote for him. I mean, Trump was the overwhelming favorite of the American working class.
And the mainstream conservatism is really in shambles at the moment. And I'm wondering if this could sway more people to the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Charlie Kirk is criticizing Martin Luther King. He's talking about the Great Replacement. I am shocked out of my wits. Mm-hmm. I did not expect that from somebody as milky toast as Charlie Kirk. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that people like Charlie Kirk, given that they have some sway over Republicans, they will be able to swing more votes for the Republican Party.
And there is a very interesting article from Paul, published at The Blaze, titled "Our Enemies Aren't as Dumb as They Seem." It was run on January the 22nd, obviously, of this year. The subtitle is "The Fact That We Find Our Opponents Profoundly Despicable Does Not Mean They Are Destined to Lose." The article begins, "Having listened to multiple reports from Republican commentators about how Joe Biden and his handlers are pursuing a disastrous border policy, I'm still not sure the Democrats have shot themselves in the foot. They may, in fact, benefit from allowing our southern border to be flooded by millions of illegal aliens. Above all, the border crisis helps them advance their obvious goal of creating a one-party state, providing the illegal immigrants can be registered expeditiously as voting citizens, something that blue state governments will no doubt hasten to do. Just because polls..." I think the article just tapered out a bit. But I'm obviously not reading any more from the article. But there's no question that polls are showing vast, vast public disapproval for what's happening at the border. And the border is a major issue in this election cycle. So, Paul, I guess explain your article a bit. Its relevance to the immigration situation is obvious. And how do you expect things to go with these enemies who are not as dumb as they seem?
Well, first of all, I should explain that I think it's likely that Trump, you know, barring some ingenious, despicable tricks by the Democrats and the even more loathsome media, should be able to win. Everything being equal, he should be able to win. But I think the Democrats are able to pull tricks and do so effectively, as they did in 2022 and 2023. They could divert attention by bringing up these largely made up issues to get certain constituents. There are certain constituencies very excited. In 2022 and 2023, we also had a border crisis, and it registered pretty high in terms of public opinion. So did crime. Nobody thought, except for Joseph Cotto, that abortion would become the leading issue, and it was made the leading issue, together with such things as, you know, paying off college to loans, which did, couldn't happen, you know, which didn't happen because it was unconstitutional. But the Democrats were able to raise issues that they could use successfully to deflect attention from the border issue. And as I pointed out, they can play all kinds of tricks now. I mean, they can tell us that the Republicans don't want them to come in because they're Nazis, anti-Semites, racists, xenophobes. These arguments, as stupid as they are, this rhetoric does succeed with many, many voters in this country. Probably almost half the voters would believe things like that. There's a very large woke left in the United States to whom these people can appeal. And they could also, you know, bringing these people in is a humanitarian act, right? I mean, we're redistributing wealth, you know, from the first world to the third world, or you call it whatever you want. But they can come up with intellectual arguments. Even if the Republicans win, I suggest, how the hell do you get rid of 10 million people who have entered illegally? I mean, DeSantis, Trump, Christine, we'll just throw them all out. You really think you're going to throw them all out? There'll be riots, right? The media will say that you're a Nazi for doing this. And, you know, this will resonate with lots and lots of people. I don't think you're going to get rid of them very easily. So, and of course, in the long run, these people will benefit the Democratic Party, maybe even the short run. But they do have their uses, and the Democrats have been able to get away with a lot. Things I did not believe they could get away with until Biden was elected.
Well, there is a video online, and I was wondering that the video could be fake, but then I did my own research, and it turns out that the video is indeed accurate. It's a video of the Somalian representative, Ilhan Omar, whatever her name is, saying that her obligation is to Somalia and to Islam. Yeah, so the Democrats will get away with that too.
But do you know the people voting for Ilhan Omar are not just Somalis? You know, they're Scandinavian Protestants voted for her in Minnesota. I mean, gives you some idea of how wacky, you know, politics are in this country. I mean, even if the Somalis were, and the blacks were not in Minnesota, they would still vote for the far left, right? The white Protestant voters who are living there. So, you know, and they'll vote overwhelmingly for Biden, or at least they'll vote for. I there's no way the Republicans can possibly win in Minnesota. Just look at the people that they elect to office, like Klobuchar, and there's all these other people who are just nutty. So I mean, there are a lot of these sort of woke white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in America. I mean, the majority are not, but there's still quite a few of them here, and. You know, they're probably told, like, they like what Ilhan Omar was saying. They probably support her.
Now, Paul, this is an interesting question, because these people claim to be very strongly in favor of the separation between church and state. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I am too. But unlike me, they would not criticize Ilhan Omar for stating her political allegiance, right, First and foremost to her religion and to, right, Somalis. So why do you think these lefties then are not cool with Reverend Jim Bob from East Jesus, Alabama, talking about being a Christian nationalist?
They hate Christianity. They're anti-Christian. They love Muslims. The same thing in Germany. I mean, they want to bring them in their special rights that they don't give to Christians and so forth. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is anti-Christian. And the Muslims are seen as the enemies of Christians. Therefore, they must be good people. And Christians should feel guilty because they're racist, sexist, whatever, even though the Muslims supposedly are not. So, I mean, this is the attitude that dominates. You know, I mean, if a Muslim cleric were to appear in the street, they would all rally that person. Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising. They're not consistent at all. You know, in the someone points out that in Germany and other countries, they allow Muslim symbols all over. They're fine. They won't allow Christian symbols. Their admiration and love of Islam is based on a cultural hatred of their own religion.
Yes, even though Muslim men will rape their women. They don't seem to care. Absolutely. One psychologist, she defended Muslim rapists. They raped a little girl and she defended them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, they just hate Christians. You know, I mean, so what can you say? I think a lot of the pro-Hamas demonstration in the United States is the same, that they associate the Jews with the Christians or something on their minds, that they're Christian colonialists, or they're standing in for the Christian colonialists. And you hear speeches like that among the pro-Hamas demonstrators.
And none of them will admit that in the Middle East, Palestine is not respected by the Arabic states. They don't care for Palestine. They even supported the British mandate. They don't care for Palestine. And they will not accept Palestinian refugees.
You know, it's interesting because I think I mentioned this to Paul in private after the events of October the 7th, that when you look at how the Israelis function and their response to what happened, which gives you a window to how they live their day-to-day lives. You see these people, as you saw Americans after 9/11, you saw them coming together. You were able to see how they deal with each other and how their society functions. They look a lot like your average suburban Republican voting person from Nebraska or from Kansas. That's how the average Israeli generally comes off.
They're not suburban. You just mean the rural.
But they look that way. That's how they look. That's the impression that's got from them. And that obviously is the constituency that the left hates. The average Israeli looks to the average American lefty like the sort of American conservative they despise. I should say exurban perhaps rather than suburban, but you know, a lot of people in their minds, they just conflate the exurbs and the suburbs, even though the exurbs are far more GOP. And obviously the rural Israelis, you know, they're to the average American lefty, completely interchangeable with the average American rural voter who is Republican. So I think there's definitely a cultural element here for people on the American left, wherein they see the Israelis as being a stand-in for conservative Americans. And that's why the American lefties have come to hate Israelis so much. They're not quote unquote cool victims. Rather, they are an extension of the Trump vote, at least in the minds of these US left wingers. Paul and Lipton, anything to say about what I brought up?
But part of it's true that Netanyahu is treated the same way as Trump, and Trump and Netanyahu are close personal friends. And Trump, went out of his way to support Netanyahu in the election. I mean, there is a close friendship there, and they tend to be on the same side of issues. Most of the American Jews who hate Trump also hate Netanyahu, and they see them as allies. They are. So it's an extension of the same mentality. Also, Netanyahu, if you remember, tried to strip the court. The Beit Din in Israel, which is created by the Knesset, you try to strip them of some of their power because they keep on intervening every time the dominant party and says that this is a violation of human rights or something. Strip them of their power, or say they can only vote once or twice if the Knesset overrules them. That's it. And this was considered some kind of attempt to destroy judicial balance, which doesn't exist there or in the United States. But the left in the United States was terrified of what Netanyahu, because the right in Europe or the United States might try the same thing, and they'd be justified if they did. But this was a real fear. And then you read, you know, the New York Times attacked Netanyahu for this, or the Washington Post did, and right now he's sort of backing down on this, and this is seen as a victory for democracy. By which we mean the Western left.
Look. I'm going to get to the point. I am pro-Israel, and in this brief monologue, I'm going to criticize both parties. So the Wall Street Journal penned an article some years ago saying that Israel spawned Hamas as a counterweight to the Palestinian Authority. The IDF has been criticized by its own soldiers. Soldiers who are part of the IDF accuse the IDF of genocide. Hamas has raped raped women from Israel. IDF soldiers, they have assaulted Palestinian women. Violence is on both sides. Violence on both sides should be condemned. But let's be realistic. Free Palestinians from what? For years, Palestinians claimed Syrian heritage. And few people have been saying so. Few. There is no Palestine history. That statement from Philip Hitti, the Arabic historian. The Palestinians are not the descendants of the Philistines or the Canaanites. Few people are willing to engage these issues. So free Palestine from what exactly? Palestinians will not do well under Hamas. They will not do well under the Palestinian Authority. Hamas wants to create a theocratic state. So free Palestine from what? That's my question.
Free Palestine is just an idea that's basically used to advance anti-Western aims, and Israel is viewed as being an adjunct of the West. So obviously the people who want to see the destruction of civilization here also want to see it in Israel. The Palestinian people are really different peoples. Palestine has people who are black, and then it has people who look Anglo, and it's because traditionally the area that, you know, people would refer to as Palestine was at the crossroads of the Ottoman Empire, and many different individuals wound up in those crossroads, and so there are many different ethnicities who are branched together since basically the 1960s as being Palestinian. When people talked about Palestine up until the whole 60s identity politics revolution, it was another name for Israel. So people would think about Jews when they thought about Palestinians.
Exactly. There is no Palestine in history. The Palestinians have been under colonial rule for centuries. They were under Ottoman rule. And when Palestine was under Ottoman rule, they were not known for revolting.
Absolutely.
They weren't aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but of course, modern nationalism had not touched them yet. nor touched the Jews. So, I think what Joseph describes is more characteristic of Jordan than of the Palestine. Jordan was the crossroads for going from Damascus down to the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. And they had these people who would protect the pilgrims during the Hajj. And some were black, some were Africans. Others came from all the way over in the Scythians in Asia. And they were all Muslims. And they all ended up settling in Jordan in their own tribes. And Jordan remains largely a tribal society. The Palestinians are probably closer to the ancient Jews than the Jews from Eastern Europe who came in, because they've been living there for thousands of years. They were probably Jews converted first to Christianity, then to Islam. They just sort of stayed in the same place. I do think they have a right to a homeland. The problem is that if I were an Israeli, I know these people would be coming to kill me. I mean, that's a problem. And I think what you have are two rights that are clashing here. And one is the right of the Jews in their own state to survive, which I think is a paramount right. And the other is the right of the Palestinians to have what I think they should have, a homeland. But that could only happen in conditions that are acceptable to the Israelis, which means they do not feel threatened with destruction by the Palestinians, which they have been threatened. You know, the Palestinians have threatened them again and again with destruction. So, I mean, they have to show that they can rule, they can live peacefully, then they can give them some territory. There isn't that much territory. That's another problem. You know, if you factor in the desert, the Negev in the south, which is two-thirds of Israel, by the way, and then you have the Negev on the Jordanian side as well, that's all desert. Outside of sort of the central corridor of Israel, which has Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and it goes north to Haifa, there isn't that much territory which you can settle. And no matter where you go, the Palestinians are right on your border. So there isn't very much land to divide. That's another problem. We'll get the Palestinians on home, and where are you going to take it from? And I suppose it's simply going to be the West Bank that they're going to give them, or something like that, and Gaza. But there's very little real estate. I mean, the whole place is probably smaller than the state of New Jersey, And, you know, I've been in Israel several times, and I was absolutely startled by how little land, how little arable land exists. Of course, you have the Negev, and I do something with it, but it is desert. And except for Bedouins, you have very few people living there. So, you know, at the end of the day, the Israelis and Palestinians will have to be able to get along to live there. And I think the Israelis will, you know, for the sake of peace, will do it, even if they'd like to have all that land for themselves. I don't know about the Palestinians, because so far they have been governed or led by very, very destructive people.
I will just say that I understand what Paul's saying about the population of Jordan, which was traditionally the Transjordan, which is a whole another history, but it's fascinating. And that definitely was at the crossroads of the Ottoman Empire. But I think it's fair to say that what we now would call Palestine or Israel was as well. But this is really just a question of interpreting historical data, not worth mulling too much over here. I think the core of the problem is, when it comes to this dispute over the Holy Land, is that the British, once they took over this former Ottoman holding as a result of the First World War, the Ottoman holding being what, you know, the Palestinians say is theirs, what the Israelis say is theirs, the British promised it to the Jews for resettlement. And the question has always been how much of this would be Jewish and how much would be reserved for the locals who were just called Arabs until much, much later. And that is the burning question to this day. Now, there was the UN partition plan in 1947 that established borders that the Jews at that time found agreeable, but you know, most of the Arabs did not find it agreeable at all, but they just basically had to go along with it because the land was held in trust for Jewish settlement, and the Jews obviously had superior technology and weaponry and, dare I say, intelligence. So they were able to really dominate after the British left, and the British left due to a guerrilla campaign against them fought by various Jewish groups. Mm-hmm. And this really brings a complicated issue, not into the present, but it sets it on a trajectory into the present day. And the question never goes away: what land is for Jews? What land is for Arabs, now called Palestinians? Mm-hmm. And the Jews have a legal right, not saying an illegal right, but they have a legal right to be settled throughout most of Israel because of the partition plan. There's no question. But the Palestinians, as we now call them, never recognized that. So it's sort of this thing that goes back to the beginning, like a hamster on a wheel running. How does this get resolved? At the end of the day, it's a question of who has the power, who has the economic power, who has the military power, who has the intellectual power, who is able to dominate the land with brute force. And Israel is able to do that right now. Will the Palestinians ever be able to do that? I don't think so. You look at the Gaza Strip, where the median IQ is 68, and it looked, before the war started, it looked like a war had already been going on there. It's hard to see a place like that, the people in that place, ever rising up to lead any sort of serious military campaign against the Israelis, who have some of the most intelligent people on earth among them. That's why the Gazans, who generally support Hamas, were relying upon Iran to basically orchestrate the October 7th attack. It's not something the Gazans would have been able to do on their own. And some say, well, Joseph, you should differentiate between Hamas and the Gazans. Well, the overwhelming majority of people in Gaza support Hamas. So, you know, really, there's a distinction without a difference. It's a terrible situation, but, you know, the whole Israel-Palestine debate is not one that's ever going to be easily resolved. And for as long as the Israelis can hold their land and expand their holdings, which they're doing with the settlements in the West Bank, and which they were doing with settlements in Gaza that were disbanded in 2005, as long as the Israelis can hold their land and extend their reach, their rule is going to continue. And that's that, regardless of anyone's moral doctrines. It is what it is. As we unfortunately begin to wind the discussion down, I'll give Paul Van Lipton, please speak your piece about this issue.
Yeah, I would point to the fact that were it not for the Iranians, they probably would not be fighting this war.
True.
And the Israelis, particularly under the Trump administration, were at the point of broken agreements with Arab countries, mm-hmm. and were on the verge of negotiating diplomatic recognition, probably some kind of at least indirect military alliance with the Saudi Arabians. But the people who are on the outs would be the Iranians. And the way they got back in was by supporting these terrorists, Hamas and Hezbollah in the north. So I don't think the Israeli position was necessarily all that desperate before that, before the Iranian intervention. I think if Trump had been reelected, we probably would not be facing these problems right now. Remember, billions and billions of dollars were paid to the Iranians by Joe Biden. I don't think this is going to affect the votes of the majority of Jews in America who are on the left, but they might want to pay attention to this. That's among the many disasters that he caused. And I think people are saying that his policy toward Iran sort of tip the scale in favor of this war are absolutely right.
My point is, I like the historical analysis, Joseph, but you omitted one variable: the agency of the Arabian elite in facilitating the sale of properties to foreigners and Jews. Mm-hmm. Historically, the Palestinians have been led astray by their leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's a big issue. Their leaders, they have stoked division and violence. Mm-hmm. They have been misled by their leaders. It's not some people like to paint the Israelis mm-hmm. as the big black dog. Okay, it could be fair, but Palestinians are being led by incompetent people. People who are willing to sacrifice their own citizens to annoy Israel. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I will just say that there are different kinds of incompetence. In Gaza, there are the fanatics of Hamas who very much don't care if their own people die. And they admit it openly. I mean, it's not like a defamation. These people who are running the Gaza Strip do not mind if Gazans die in a conflict. They believe it is the role of others to make sure that a humanitarian disaster doesn't happen, which just goes to show how little respect there is for human life in Gaza on a cultural level, that people would support a government that does this to them, and yet they back it overwhelmingly. It's sickening, but it is what it is.
They're billionaires.
Pardon me?
They're billionaires.
Oh, yeah, the people around Hamas.
Yeah.
Yes, they're billionaires.
Yes, and then in the West Bank, it's a different story. The people who run it are sworn enemies of Hamas. They actually had a civil war with Hamas that they just barely won. This was in the 2000s. And they are more amenable to doing business with Israel, no question. If you're talking about the Abbas faction, the Mahmoud Abbas faction, the folks in the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, they actually are so unpopular, even in the West Bank, that they banned elections from being held. So if people in the West Bank were able to vote, they vote for Hamas, despite Hamas doing so terribly for the people in Gaza. But the incompetence in the West Bank is different than the incompetence in Gaza. In the West Bank, it's more straight up corruption, typical, third world style banana republicanism. There's nothing really all that unique about it. It's just same old nonsense that you see in post-colonial societies. The government in Gaza is infinitely more severe and destructive than the government in the West Bank, even though the government of Palestine on the whole is absolutely not worth having. As we conclude tonight, Paul Van Lipton, give Lipton the final word, since he's on the show less than Paul is. Anything to say about any matters that we've discussed this evening? There have been so many of them.
We have discussed several issues. I want to diverge a bit to mention E. Jean Carroll. That story is incredulous. I don't take her seriously, and Trump might have to pay over $80 million.
Mm-hmm.
A kangaroo justice system.
The trial was handled disgustingly by the so-called judge. That's putting
Who knows her attorney? The judge knows her attorney.
Yeah, it's a real that whole thing is a real rat's nest, to say the least. Paul, anything to bring
up? Yeah, now that Lipton has mentioned this, my next article is on this. I think what the Democrats did again was despicable but brilliant. This lady claimed that she was mishandled, or there's no evidence he was raped. He probably groped her around 1992 or something. And she is a very embattled Democrat. She writes for very, very leftist publications. And she also claims that she was groped and raped, in fact, by a number of men. I mean, this came out in New York Magazine. And when Trump said that she was a wacko, he was probably right. But she was, now she's 80, but at one point she was Miss Indiana, or Miss Indiana University, or something like that, back in the 1960s. And she thinks of herself as a very attractive woman, and is convinced that Donald Trump did something to her. He denied it, but then he also said something that was insulting about her. Now, this happened in 1992, but it became an issue just as Donald Trump was going to run for president again. It was just a coincidence that this came up at that time. And they got him for a few million dollars, and they decided to try him again, as they're trying him for other things in New York State, you know, take away his business operations. And Alvin Bragg, the district attorney in New York, is going after him for something else. So they decided to throw the book at him, and they found him liable for insulting this lady, whether or not he really raped her back in 1992, and what is more, he should pay her $83 million. That's what the jury decided. Now, we can have some idea of what the politics of that jury was, right? now that the Democrat and the mass media in America love it, they support Ms. Carroll, they support Judge Kaplan, they support the jury. They think it's great. Anything they do to get Trump is the mass media in America and in Europe, they love it. It's fine. So now that they have this down path, they can go on doing this to Republicans. Not only Trump, but to other Republicans as well.
That's the scary thing. It sets a precedent. I will say that what happened with this case, we're not get into it in any great detail, just very cursory. The jury found Trump liable, which is different from guilty. This is not proof beyond reasonable doubt. It's preponderance of the evidence because it's a civil proceeding. The jury found Trump liable for molestation, but it found that he was not liable for rape.
Right.
And then it was claimed that Trump defamed Carroll. So there was a judgment against him for the alleged molestation. Then there was a judgment against him for defamation. And the judge in the defamation case did not let Trump's lawyer present any sort of case. He was as biased as it could possibly get him. Sure that his action will result in the case to some degree being handled favorably for Trump on appeal. It would not surprise me if the whole thing is tossed out. But the fact of the matter is, it was funded, Gene Carroll's defense was funded by Reid Hoffman, hardcore Democrat who also was funding Nikki Haley against Trump. The law was changed in New York State, which destroyed the statute of limitations. That allowed Carroll to bring forth her allegation in court of abuse against Trump. So this whole thing, a Democrat was funding her lawsuit. Her lawyer hates Trump. The Democratic New York government changed the statute of limitations, which allowed the Carroll to bring her stuff to court against Trump. The judge, which screwed Trump over in the defamation case, was appointed by Bill Clinton. It's as simple as it gets. It is what it is. And it has not moved the needle of public opinion. Anything, it's actually helped Trump because he's improved in the polls since this whole damn thing began. So I don't think it went the way the Democrats wanted in terms of how people perceive it. I wonder if they even really care at this point, or if they're just trying to be as spiteful as possible for the sake of being spiteful. That's what people typically do when their strategies have gone down the sewer and they are just left to throw excrement at the wall. That seems to be where they are now. This case will take years upon years to be ultimately resolved. I mean, it's going to the appellate court right now, but the appeals courts don't take defamation cases very quickly. They're considered to be the lowest priority, essentially, in the civil court system. It's not like the Colorado case that, you know, went from the Colorado Supreme Court to the U.S. Supreme Court with lightning-fast record speed. This is going to go to the appellate court whenever they have time for it, literally. And it's going to take a while there. The appellate court, if, you know, once it issues its ruling, whoever is on the losing side will appeal to the Supreme Court, and then it will take even more time for the Supreme Court to consider this. Whether they do or they don't take it is another matter. They probably won't, but still it takes time. Alternatively, the appellate court can send it back down to the district court, and then whoever comes out on the losing side of the district court ruling would take it back to the appellate court, and then from the appellate court it would go back to, it would go potentially go up to the Supreme Court. The bottom line is that this whole thing would take probably about half a decade at minimum to be resolved ultimately, more like probably 5 to 7 years. It's going to be a non-issue by the time it's done, in my opinion. I think E. Jean Carroll is profoundly unlikely to actually see any of Donald Trump's money. I really do. I think she knows that. I think her lawyers know that. I think this whole thing was intended. It was obviously intended to harm Donald Trump, his public image. And I really believe that it has not been successful in that. I mean, if somebody sues somebody for what she was suing Trump for, and then he sued for defamation, obviously you want to make this guy seem far from rosy in the eyes of most people. You're trying to make a statement about him. And she found, or people found her, it could have been either way, who supported her aim of detracting from Trump's image. And so that's how this whole thing plays out. It's really, you know, terrible. It's lawfare, and certainly the Democrats now see a strategy they could use against people far less wealthy than Trump. But my opinion as to how, as to what E. Jean Carroll's motivation was, and as to why people on the Democratic side joined up with her, I think my opinion is pretty solid here. This will be used again, I'm sure of that. I'm also sure that this case will take years and years to be resolved. And I don't think E. Jean Carroll will ever see any of the money.
That's very consoling to learn.
Yeah, indeed. But
he's also so old, as am I, that he may never live to see the
yes. But I'm laughing because of the, what's her name, Fanny Willis? Is that her name?
Yes.
Yeah, she's in hot water too.
Oh, yes, she is. She's very, very much in hot water. That's a whole nother thing. But that is much more consequential for Trump than anything to do with E. Jean Carroll. Because that's, you know, she's bringing, Fannie Willis is bringing a criminal case against Donald Trump. So that seems to be going in a very positive direction for Trump, the Georgia case, but it will take time to really know what it will amount to. But I think it's certain to say he won't be on trial before Election Day. If that case goes to trial at all, it very well may not. Now, I think that about wraps up for tonight. We've really had a great comprehensive discussion about many things. I have enjoyed it. Paul and Lipton, I hope you have enjoyed this chat as much as I have.
Yes, I have. You rouse me from my my anxiety.
You know, I've always want Paul to anoint me as his successor, as his heir. I've always wanted him to do that on this show.
I think that Paul will think it over. And perhaps during the next episode that we all do, he will have a follow-up. It's a very prestigious thing to be Paul's successor. I mean, that's something else. I mean, there are certainly many candidates for chief.
Pedro Gonzalez.
I would like it if Pedro Gonzalez came on my show, but he really doesn't seem interested in doing so. I wonder why. Anyway, that is all for tonight, everyone. I hope you have enjoyed this chat as much as Paul and Lipton and I have. It certainly has been an informative one. We covered a lot of ground in a relatively short period of time. Please stay safe, be well, and cheers.